concrete, 4 inches in diameter, 16 feet tall, and 1,500 feet away from the detonation, was also vaporized. In the control station, there was silence. In the place of the worry that had led up to the event, every person who had seen it now felt awe and uncertainty. As if coming out of a trance, the team members looked around, unsure what to do. Some shook hands, congratulating each other. A few people laughed. Several cried. All believed that in the New Mexico desert that morning, the world had changed forever. The first atomic bomb had been detonated. They hoped it would be the last. Back at Los Alamos, a team member raised a glass. To the dawn of the atomic age! Many had feared the test would be a dud. The feeling most of them now felt was relief. For a few, it was fear. Robert spoke for the first time since the Trinity test. Yes, a new age indeed. We have given the human race something it has never possessed before, the means with which to destroy itself. When no one responded, he added, How long will it be before a madman acquires our device and uses it? 5 years? 10? 100? I wonder which will be the last generation of humans. Our children? Perhaps our grandchildren? When the group broke, Robert's supervisor followed him back to his office and closed the door behind him. Robert had come to respect and trust the older man, and so the words he said gave him great pause. Did you mean what you said? Every word. We've opened Pandora's box. His supervisor studied him a moment. Be careful what you say, Robert. Some people here aren't what they seem. Less than a month later, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second bomb fell on Nagasaki. Death toll estimates ranged from 129,000 to 246,000. The depression Robert had fought his entire life finally overwhelmed him. When he stopped coming to work, his supervisor visited him at his home. Did you know? Robert asked. Not the specifics, only that the bombs would be used to end the war. We killed those people. The war would have dragged on for years. Robert shook his head. We should have dropped it just outside Tokyo, where the emperor and the residents could see it, then blanketed the city with leaflets demanding they surrender or overthrow their government. Toppling governments is a messy proposition and unpredictable. Besides, Tokyo has been firebombed far worse than the damage that would have resulted from an atomic bomb outside the city. During 2 days in March alone, we burned 16 square miles of it. What's your point? My point is that the decision, no matter what you think of it, was not yours to make. You feel blame. You shouldn't. It was war. You did your job. Perhaps. But I can't help feeling as though nothing matters anymore. I know now that the project gave me something I needed, purpose, and belief in what I was creating. Yet having seen the horror of it, I know now that I was a fool. The die is cast. Our extinction is merely a matter of time. The older man sat quietly for a moment. What if I told you there was a group of scientists and intellectuals, people like ourselves from around the world, who believed as you do, that humanity has now become a danger to itself? What if I told you that this group was working on a sort of second Manhattan Project, a technology that might one day save the entire human race? This device would be controlled by the people who built it, intellectuals with only the common good in mind, not nationalism or religion or money. If such a group existed, I would be very interested in hearing more. Several months later, the two men traveled to London. They were shocked at the state of the city. The war, and in particular the Blitz, had leveled entire sections. Others lay in ruins. But the endless attacks had not broken the British, and now they were rebuilding. At 1 a.m., a car took the men to a private club. They made their way up the grand staircase and into a ballroom, where a lectern stood before rows of chairs. Signs emblazoned with three words hung above the stage. Reason, ethics, and physics. The attendees filed in silently and faced forward. Robert estimated that there were 60 people in the room. What that speaker said that night changed Robert's life forever. A month later, Robert and his wife Sarah moved to London. The city had one of the largest concentrations of universities in the world, and he was offered several positions, all arranged by Sitium members. He took a job at King's College and published a paper from time to time, but his real work was done in secret. The protocols were largely copied from the Manhattan Project. Independent teams working on components of a larger device. What the larger device was, he didn't know. Only that it would save humanity from itself, from the deadly device he'd helped to create during the war. Working on the Looking Glass was the solution to the depression he'd experienced after the atomic bombs had been dropped. He believed he was creating the antidote to the poison he'd injected into the world. That gave him hope. His wife also found solace in her work, volunteering at one of the city's many orphanages. For years, she and Robert had tried to have a child, but without success. It was hard on her. Being a mother was something she wanted more than anything. One Saturday, she asked him to come with her to the orphanage. The facility was a converted hotel, and though it was a bit run down, it was clean. He visited with several of the children, read stories, and gave out small toys and books his wife had brought with them that day. She asked him to join her again the following Saturday, and the next. Soon it became their ritual. He knew she was working up to something, and he knew what it was. And he knew what he would say. She asked him on a Sunday afternoon, without preamble, as if she were confirming a decision they had already made. "I think we should adopt him." "Yes, certainly," he replied, not even glancing up from the paper. I was the boy they adopted, and to understand what that meant to me, you have to know what happened during the war. Chapter 78. On the day Germany invaded Poland, they evacuated the children from London. There had been rumors of mass evacuations for months. That night, my parents fought about it. I didn't understand it at the time. Later, I learned the truth. My father had insisted my mother leave London, too. She was an assistant professor at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies and spoke and taught courses in three foreign languages, Japanese, Arabic, and German. My mother's school was set to move to Christ Church in Cambridge. All of London's colleges and universities were being evacuated, but she wanted to stay and assist in the war effort, and she wasn't taking no for an answer. My father was no pushover. He was a captain in the British 3rd Infantry, currently under the command of Bernard Montgomery. But he folded that night. The next morning, she walked me to the train station. The line of children seemed endless. I would later learn that the mass evacuations were called Operation Pied Piper, and that over 3.5 million people were displaced. In the first 3 days of September, over 1.5 million people were moved, including over 800,000 school-aged children, over 500,000 mothers and young children, 13,000 pregnant mothers, and 70,000 disabled people. Another 100,000 teachers and support personnel were moved. The effort was massive. It seemed the entire city of London was focused on it. They pinned a placard with my name on it to my coat and gave me a cardboard box which hung around my neck. A gas mask lay inside, a grim reminder that this was no field trip. Many kids took them out and put them on and played with them. I was a boy of 5, and I must admit that I did too. Older siblings held their younger brothers and sisters' hands, ensuring they didn't get separated. My only brother had died 2 years before from tuberculosis. I would have given anything for him to be holding my hand that morning. I put on a brave face for my mother, though. She hugged me so hard I thought my chest would collapse. As the train pulled away, she waved goodbye. She was crying. In fact, I didn't see a single dry eye on that platform. 11 years later, C.S. Lewis wrote a novel titled The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, in which 4 siblings are evacuated from London to a stately country manor home with a dusty wardrobe that leads to another world. The evacuations weren't nearly as romantic as Lewis's tale, but they also weren't as agonizing as The Lord of the Flies, William Golding's novel about boys evacuated from London who crash land on a tropical island. On the whole, everyone in Britain was doing the best they could, and preparing for the worst. War with Germany. My parents had arranged for me to stay with my mother's first cousin Edith and her husband George. It was a few days before they could come around to collect me, and in that time I got a glimpse of what the children without host families went through. Periodically they were brought out and made to line up while adults marched past. "I'll take that one," a mother said. "We'll take the 3rd from the left," a father called out. The first time it happened was sort of like not being picked for cricket. It wasn't the end of the world, but these rounds of selections had a cumulative effect on the children left behind. I felt for them. Would have traded places with them. but there was nothing anyone could do. Most of those who remained were shuffled around, some assigned to the evacuation camps the government had built, in itself an act of great foresight. Life became routine for a while. I went to school, did my chores as Edith bade me, just as my mother insisted I should in her letters. Her notes to me arrived every few days. My father wrote less often, and shorter letters, but I was glad to hear from both of them. In the den, Edith and I listened to the radio each night, hanging on every word of the BBC News report. George was in the Royal Air Force, and she was worried to death about him, though she tried quite hard to hide it. In May of 1940, Germany launched its offensive to the west. They took the Low Countries first. The Netherlands and Belgium fell quickly, providing the German army a route around the Maginot Line. They broke through in the Ardennes, separating the French and British armies. I knew my father had been deployed, but I didn't know where. I went cold when I heard that the 3rd Infantry had been one of the divisions evacuated at Dunkirk. A letter arrived from my father 2 weeks later. I cried in my room that night, because he was alive. Somewhere deep inside, I had convinced myself that he was dead, and that I was okay with it. 4 months later, in early September, a year after I left London, the Luftwaffe began their air raids on the city. Starting on September 7th of 1940, they bombed London 56 out of the following 57 days. The attacks were relentless and deadly. The bombings killed over 40,000 people, injured at least 40,000 more, and destroyed over 1 million homes. My mother was in one of those homes, and she was one of the 40,000 who lost her life. I had been so concerned about my father's safety that her death caught me completely by surprise. I was filled with both hatred and sadness. At only 6 years old, the emotions overwhelmed me. I worried for my father, and then I tried not to care. But that was a lie, I told myself. On D-Day, the 3rd Infantry was the first to land at Sword Beach as part of the invasion of Normandy. I feared the worst when I heard that, but a letter arrived from my father 3 weeks later. Those letters continued to come for 6 months. I was hopeful. That was my mistake. The news that he had been killed in December destroyed whatever was left of my young heart. I was officially an orphan. George returned home the following month. He had lost a leg and the better part of an arm, and the physical wounds were only half of his struggle. I helped Edith as best I could, but like me, she was overwhelmed. I knew what was coming next, and I didn't blame her. The orphanage in London was filled with other children who had lost their families in the war and had nowhere else to go. I shared a small room with 3 other boys. The youngest, Edgar Mayweather, was 6. I was the oldest at 11, and there were 2 brothers staying with us. Orville Hughes was 9, and his younger brother Alistair was 7. The orphanage was in a run-down hotel on the outskirts of London. It had barely survived the bombings. Our days consisted of school and chores that were done under the threat of bodily punishment. We helped repair the old hotel, too. On the whole, things could have been a lot worse. We were fed, educated, and looked after. The hard work, at least for me, took my mind off what had happened and gave me a sense of purpose. Perhaps the only thing we didn't have was love. No matter how much they hid it, every kid in the orphanage was out of sorts. Growing up with tragedy changes a person, trains them to expect still more tragedy around every corner. It's the mind's way of protecting you, and it is a very powerful defense. At night, many children cried endlessly in the dark. Some hid under their beds. Many were spooked at every loud sound. I didn't blame them. It was sort of like being in prison, in a way. And just like in prison, none of us asked the other orphans questions about what they were in for. We'd seen enough of the war. No one wanted to talk about it. We all handled it in our own way. Many of the kids fought. They'd fight you for a cross word or even the wrong look. They were mad about life and what had happened and would take it out on anyone and anything. The Orville was 2 years younger than me. He was bigger and as tough as a bucket of nails. I never saw him start a fight, but he ended more than his share. His fists and elbows saved me many broken bones and black eyes. He guarded his younger brother Alistair like the Queen's jewels. Me and Edgar, too. Alistair was pretty tough himself, but less eager to fight. He was quiet, always had his nose in a book. Turnover was high. Kids were always being brought in or taken out. We knew some were moved to other orphanages as they opened. Most, however, were placed with families. I got another taste of what I'd seen during the evacuations. Parents coming through, inspecting the kids, making their decisions, and then leaving the rest of us to wash up, comb our hair, and put on our best set of clothes for the next audition. Rejection eats at a person like a worm winding its way through an apple. Sooner or later, it reaches the core, and you become completely rotten. I never got there, but I saw a lot of kids who did. After my parents died, I told myself I didn't care what happened to me. But I did. I didn't want to grow up in an orphanage, with friends who came and went like ships in the night. I wanted a mother and a father, and a home that only we lived in. I wasn't the only one. One Sunday afternoon, a group called the Christian Brothers visited the orphanage. They described a better life, work outside in the fields, families ready to take us, a wonderful school in an exciting place called Australia. It sounded a lot better than this place, but I was skeptical. It sounded too good to me. But not to many of the others. Hands went up around the room. As they did, the kids were called forward. One of those hands was Alistair Hughes. Orville reached for him to put it down, but it was too late. They were already ushering him into the crowd to leave. Orville joined them without a word. He nodded to me as he left. I learned later that all was not as the Christian Brothers had promised. The program was actually the continuation of similar initiatives in the 17th century, when children were shipped to the Virginia colony as migrant labor. In the 19th and 20th centuries, nearly 150,000 children were sent to Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Rhodesia. They worked in harsh conditions, but the work was only part of their suffering. From the 1940s until 1967, about 10,000 children were shipped to Western Australia to work in the fields and live in orphanages. Physical and sexual abuse was rampant and only discovered in later years. In 2009, Australia's Prime Minister formally apologized to those children who had suffered under the program for what he called the absolute tragedy of childhoods lost. I, too, was watching my childhood slip away. I had started to grow pessimistic that I would ever find a home when a woman named Sarah Moore began volunteering at the orphanage. She was kind and very smart. She reminded me of my mother. She taught me French, which I picked up quickly to her delight. Her husband was more stoic, but I thought he liked me too. One Sunday, the woman in charge of our ward told me to make ready to leave. I was scared to death as I stuffed my meager belongings in the sack they'd given me. I was overjoyed when Sarah and her husband Robert came into the room and told me I was coming to live with them. Against my will, I cried, but that was okay with them. They simply hugged me and loaded my things into their shiny car and drove away. I took their last name, but kept my original family surname as my middle name. In school the next year, I couldn't have been more proud when I signed my first paper, William Kensington Moore. Peyton stood and moved to the corkboard, scanning it again, her eyes locked on a worn picture pinned near the floor. She pulled it from the board and studied it. Three children stood there. On the left was a girl, perhaps 3 years old. In the middle stood a girl of perhaps 7, and on the right was a boy of 11 with only one arm. "I know who wrote this," she said. Desmond moved to her side and gazed at the picture. "You do?" She pointed at the youngest girl in the picture. "That's me. Madison's in the middle. Andrew on the right. William Kensington Moore is my father." Chapter 79. Desmond tried to process Peyton's words.
"I thought you said your father was dead."
"I thought he was," she replied. "Maybe he is. We don't know when this letter was written."
She returned to the couch, sat down beside Desmond, and pulled the thick quilt back over her. Outside the stone cottage, the sunrise broke through the fog. She wondered how long Avery would be asleep, how long they had before they'd need to make a decision, and what they'd find in the rest of the pages. "What I remember about the first years after the war was that Britain was broke. We'd won the Second World War, but it had come at a fantastic cost, most of all in lives, but also in pounds and pence. America suddenly and unexpectedly ended the Lend-Lease program that had likely saved us. The Treasury was near bankruptcy. So began the age of austerity. It seemed we'd survived the Nazis only to starve to death, and we weren't the only ones. The entire world was freezing, starving, and still reeling from the greatest conflict in human history. In Britain, rationing and conscription continued. The winter of 1946 to 1947 was one of the worst in recorded history. Coal and railway systems failed, factories closed, and people were very, very cold. Things turned a little each year. The Americans loaned us $3.75 billion at a low interest rate in July of 1946. The Marshall Plan launched in 1948, further bolstering our financial situation. Everyone felt that the next war was right around the corner. I did too. It was hard not to. But the world was doing everything it could to stop it and to get ready. The United Nations was formed in 1945, NATO in 49. Britain began giving its colonies independence, Jordan in 46, India and Pakistan in 47, Israel, Myanmar, and Sri Lanka in 48. Even more nations gained independence from the UK during the 50s and 60s. Sudan, Ghana, Malaysia, Nigeria, Kuwait, Sierra Leone, Tanzania, Jamaica, Uganda, and Kenya. The country was back on its feet by 1950, but all eyes were now on the Soviet Union and the expanding Cold War. The UK joined the US in the Korean War that year, fighting the Chinese and the Soviet Union in what we all believed was a dress rehearsal for the next global war. It ended in a stalemate, and the country was split in two. The US and Russia began mass-producing nuclear weapons, amassing thousands, enough to alter the Earth permanently, making it uninhabitable. Other nations developed their own nuclear weapons, the UK, France, Israel, India, China, and Pakistan. Despite the whole world going crazy, life settled down for me at home. My teenage years were a sharp contrast to the turbulent first 12 years of my life. Mother and father, as I'd come to refer to Sarah and Robert, were loving to me, fair but firm, and never were there two parents who cared for a child more. They didn't dote on me, but they gave me every scrap of spare time and energy they had. Mother was adamant about my keeping up with chores and my schoolwork. Father always had a project he wanted us to do, usually science-related. I knew early on that he imagined me following in his footsteps. To him, science was the noblest endeavor, and physics towered above all other sciences. But like every child becoming an adult, I learned the limits of my abilities. Where science and math were concerned, those boundaries didn't extend nearly far enough. I would never be a great scientist, or even a bad one. My mind just wasn't wired that way. I did excel at languages, however. Perhaps it was a gift from my biological mother. Picking up a foreign tongue was a piece of cake for me. And I loved history, military history in particular. I read everything I could about the 3rd Infantry, the division in which my biological father had served and died. I devoured histories of Germany and the British Empire. University came and went, and my only notable accomplishments occurred in the boxing ring. I had no clue what I wanted to do with my life. Like so many others with the same problem, I joined the army. It seemed a noble pursuit, and a good place to get my bearings and maybe see a little of the world. It was the right decision. In the army, I learned leadership and how to manage people. University had stuffed my head full of facts and knowledge and had taught me how to think and solve problems, but I had only ever managed myself. The army was a boon to me in that respect. It also gave me perhaps the greatest gift of my entire life. It revealed who I was. It tested me in ways school never had. I found I was at my best during a crisis. In clutch situations, when I had to make fast decisions, I never faltered. And I lived for those moments, just as I'd looked forward to the boxing ring. But more so, for in real life, there was no referee to pull you apart, no bell to ring. To this day, I believe a person's ideal first job is the one that reveals the most about them. Knowing who I was helped me avoid a lot of dead ends in life. A lot of opportunities look good, but I found that sometimes success and happiness or about knowing when to say no. I avoided routine. I liked moving around, doing something different every day. Maybe it was because of how I grew up during the war, being shuffled around, but it became my way of life. I moved from post to post, always the first to volunteer for a transfer. I never wanted my feet to go to sleep. Just before my first tour of duty ended, a man came to see me. He asked if I was interested in a new type of opportunity. A way to serve Her Majesty's government in a far greater capacity than I currently was. They had me with the patriotic pitch. The job interview was a complex, bizarre process that would fill a book. I imagine it was a little different for each of us who joined in those days. They vetted me, tested me some more, then began my real training. A year later, in 1959, I became an employee of the Gibraltar Trading Company. On the surface, I was an antiques dealer. My job entailed a lot of travel, exchanging large sums of money with foreigners and foreign governments, recovering relics lost in the war. But in truth, I was an agent for Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6, as it was predominantly known then. I'd never been so filled with purpose, or happier. My mother had been worried about me when I joined the army. My position with Gibraltar Trading soothed her nerves considerably.
My father's reaction was quite unexpected, a mixture of amusement and appreciation. He seemed to know exactly what I was up to, and our relationship actually improved. We began to have long conversations, philosophical in nature. I discovered a whole new side of him. In short, he opened up to me, taking an interest in me as he never had before, or at least not since before university, when it became clear that I was never going to be a scientist. I knew that had disappointed him, though he never voiced it and never showed it. Like all parents, he just wanted me to value the things he valued. In some way, he wanted me to carry on his work. When I visited home from my trips, I brought small trinkets, which my mother displayed in the parlor and my father placed on shelves in his study. He asked me about the trips with an amused look on his face, as if he knew what had truly taken place. On Easter weekend in 1965, I learned just how much he knew. I sat in his study, completely unprepared for what he was about to tell me. "I'd like you to come with me to Hong Kong next week." "Can't. I have a meeting with a new client in Warsaw." He stood, walked to a shelf to the left of his desk, and moved a few items out of the way. He pushed the shelf's back panel. It clicked and sprang open, revealing a small safe, which he opened. He drew out a picture and handed it to me. 20 years ago, I helped create that device. I'd seen the image before many times. This was a photo, an original, printed by someone who was there at the first atomic bomb test. I had never known father was involved. I've regretted it every day since. Do you know how many nuclear warheads exist today? Still studying the picture, I said, 37,741, give or take. And they're far more powerful than the ones dropped on Japan. He paused, waited for me to look at him. Communism isn't humanity's greatest enemy. Indeed, we are the greatest enemy we now face. For the first time in history, we have the means with which to destroy ourselves. I helped give that deadly weapon to the world. I've spent the years since trying to ensure it is never used again. How? I'm part of an organization that's creating a new device, a device that will change the human race. Its reach will be unlimited. It will affect every person, of every nationality and race and religion. It will save us. It may well be our only chance of survival. I was skeptical. In fact, I half wondered if the long hours in his lab had finally gotten to him. "What sort of device?" I asked. "I'll tell you that in due time. You of all people know the importance of secrecy." I was sure of it then. He knew I was a spy. "The looking glass is the culmination of my life's work. It's in danger now. We're entering a phase of the project where our work will be more exposed. There's greater risk. I need someone to protect it. I think you might be that person." He stared at me a moment. "Will you come with me to Hong Kong?" I agreed instantly. I felt pride that day, that he had asked me, that I had grown into someone who could help him, after everything he had done for me. Hong Kong in 1965 was booming. The streets were clogged with people, and factories were springing up at every turn. More than half the population were young people about my age, in their mid-20s and early 30s. Walking the crowded sidewalks, with double-decker buses zooming by, belching heavy black smoke and releasing passengers every few blocks, I realized that Hong Kong, in so many ways, was an Asian facsimile of London, British-style government and capitalism, but with a fusion of culture from the East and West. That night, my father and I strolled through the city, lit not by yellow streetlights like the London of my youth, but bathed in red and blue neon signs that stretched from street level to high above, featuring words written in Cantonese. Disco music wafted into the streets as strongly as the scent of roasted pig and beef from the eateries. We'd had a drink at our hotel and another at dinner. I've forgotten the names of the hotel and the restaurant, but I remember how I felt about Hong Kong that night. As if I were seeing the future. As if every city would one day be like this blooming metropolis, a melting pot of human culture. Young people were flocking in from China and the rest of the world. Hong Kong was the first trip I had taken with my father as an adult. Our relationship had changed, and that was evident now, as we embarked on this adventure together. In the harbor lay the vessel that would change my life, and perhaps soon the world. It was a submarine, the largest non-military sub I'd ever seen. It was nuclear-powered, with a diesel-electric backup. The tour of the vessel lasted an hour. I was shocked by what I saw. It was a massive laboratory capable of circling the globe. I paused at the nameplate, which read, RSV Beagle, Hong Kong, 1 May 1965, Ordo Ab Cao. I translated the Latin words in my head. From chaos comes order. My line of work had taken me behind the Iron Curtain routinely,
Order existed there, but the price was high. Freedom. I wondered what this vessel's builders demanded for the order they sought, and what that order was. Back in our hotel that night, my father told me the role I was to play. The Beagle's mission will require it to travel to dangerous places. Some are hard to reach physically. Others are dangerous politically. The Soviet Union. China. Among others, he said. I was in the army, not the navy. Your role will be securing operations on the shore. That's where the true danger lies. The sub will dock at ports all over the world. You'll need to think fast. Be ready for anything. Negotiate with customs. Get our people out of sticky situations. He paused, letting me consider the words. I know your current work is very important, but so is this. If I'm right, it's the most important thing the human race has ever done. The world may well avoid a nuclear holocaust, but there will always be another device, another war. We are the enemy we face. The human race is on borrowed time. We are far too uncivilized to possess the weapons we do. We're racing the clock, just as we were during the Manhattan Project. Will you help us? I agreed then and there in that hotel room. I wondered what sort of device the looking glass was. I assumed the answer would be revealed in those first days aboard the Beagle. What I found was far more intriguing. Chapter 80. In the small cottage in Shetland, the sun had risen, driving the fog away. The wind still whipped across the stone, rattling the ancient windows every few minutes. Desmond stood to stretch his legs. At the corkboard, he scanned an article about the Invisible Sun Foundation donating $10 million to a genetics project at Stanford. Peyton moved toward him, but he turned and motioned her back to the couch. Let's keep going. As he sat down, an object caught his eye. It was in the corner of the room, where the wall met the ceiling. It was well hidden by several trinkets at the top of a bookshelf, but there was no mistaking what it was, a camera. At the bottom, a small light glowed red. Desmond hoped the camera was simply a leftover security measure the cottage owner had installed. There wasn't much he could do about it at the moment except run, and that would tip off anyone watching. He focused on the pages of the story and began reading again. The Beagle was an incredible vessel, but most impressive to me were the people aboard. They were drawn from all over the world, American, British like myself, Germans, Chinese, Russians, Japanese. They were nearly all scientists, except for the staff who operated the submarine and me and my three security personnel. I must say we non-scientists felt a bit out of place at first. On the mess deck, all the talk was of the experiments. I had expected there to be just one experiment. On that point, I was very wrong. The Beagle was in some ways a floating university with multiple departments, each with specialists in the field, all of them conducting different research. We took ice core samples in Antarctica, collected soil samples from the ocean floor, and took on animals from all over the world. Human test subjects were common, people from all nations and races, and were taken to labs that were off-limits to non-essential personnel. All this activity baffled me. How could all of this be related to one project? Of course, nothing inspires curiosity like a secret. Like the sailors, I did my share of speculating and prodding the scientists about what they were researching. I knew the vessel's namesake, the HMS Beagle, had carried a young Charles Darwin on the voyage around the world that helped him form his theory of natural selection. I wondered if the scientists on this vessel were testing a theory as groundbreaking. I've never been claustrophobic, but my time on the Beagle tested my comfort level with confinement. The crew quarters were small and separated by gender. The bunks were stacked three tall, with 12 of us to a berth. We shared a shower the sailors called a rain locker. They called the bunks racks or bunkies. Indeed, the men who ran the sub seemed to have a language all their own, mostly comprised of curse words. Sailors not pulling their weight were called bent shitcans. Sailors who only looked out for themselves were check valves. Surface ships and sailors were skimmers, a derogatory term apparently. Passages were peeways. Radiation was zoomies. Marine life spotted on sonar, dolphins and whales, were called biologics. Clear your baffles meant to look behind you. Poking holes in the ocean meant we were underway. There was a locker dedicated to holding porn, known as the smut locker. On the whole, I felt more of a connection to the sailors than to the scientists. That changed when I got to know my bunkmate, Yuri Pachenko. Yuri was 33, about 2 years older than me and smaller, but his size belied his strength, which lay mostly in his mind. He was the most intense person I'd ever met. His story revealed why. He had been a child in Stalingrad when the German Sixth Army had arrived in August of 1942. I'd read about the battle, of course,
was one of the deadliest battles in the history of warfare, with millions of lives lost. Hearing his story firsthand made my experience during the war seem like a holiday in the country. The evacuations had largely spared Britain's children the horrors of the war, but in the Soviet Union there had been nowhere to run. Yuri had fought for his land and scraped to survive. And now he wanted to create a world where Stalingrad never happened again. I've never seen anyone so focused on anything. His field was virology, and he was learning from the best in the world, who apparently were on board the Beagle. In August of 1967, we docked in Mombasa. Yuri and a team rushed to Uganda to investigate a viral outbreak. They brought samples back. Containment was instituted in the labs, and for good reason. I later learned the virus they'd brought on board was Marburg, a hemorrhagic fever close in nature to Ebola, which was discovered in Zaire about 10 years later. I found one scientist much more interesting than the others, Lynn Keller. She was the child of a Chinese mother and a German father, and she had grown up in Hong Kong during the war. She described in vivid terms living through the fall of the island. On the same day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, they also attacked the British colony of Hong Kong. Local troops, as well as British, Canadian, and Indian units, fought hard for the island but lost to the overwhelming Japanese forces. They surrendered on Christmas Day, 1941, what the locals would call Black Christmas. The Japanese occupation of Hong Kong followed. From the Peninsula Hotel in Kowloon, the Japanese ruled with an iron fist. Lynn and her mother were separated from her father, who was in Germany, forced to work for the German government. Though he could have brought his family to Germany, he'd felt she was safer in Hong Kong despite the conditions. They barely scraped by during the 3 years and 8 months, as the occupation came to be known. The situation on mainland China was far worse. The Japanese had invaded in July of 1937, beginning the Second Sino-Japanese War. The conflict was massive in scale and loss of human life. It would account for the majority of civilian and military casualties in the Pacific War and claim the lives of 10 to 25 million Chinese civilians and over 4 million Chinese and Japanese military. The war in China exemplified a fact often forgotten about the Second World War. Globally, more non-combatants perished than uniformed participants. Civilians in China and the Soviet Union suffered the most, but hunger and violence were a fact of life around the world in the early 40s. That was the world Yuri, Lin, and I had grown up in. It was a world we didn't want our children to grow up in. We were going to change it no matter the cost. And in each other we found kindred spirits, linked by a shared childhood across thousands of miles and two continents. Lin's field was genetics, and the subject was an obsession for her. Her father was also conducting genetic research on the Beagle, which meant that in addition to the research opportunity, her time here was a chance to reconnect with him. This was something Lin and I shared in common. The Sishim was an opportunity to connect with our fathers, to share in their life's work, and perhaps even to fill in some of the years of our childhoods we had lost. Genetics was a booming field. Watson and Crick had figured out that DNA was arranged in a double helix in 1953, and the discoveries had accelerated after that. When Lynn talked about the promise of genetics, she lit up. She was unlike any woman I'd ever met. Physically, she was an anomaly, the embodiment of Hong Kong itself, distinctly Asian features with a mixture of British mannerisms and behavior. She was unassuming, utterly without ego. Perhaps that was what attracted me the most. She was hardworking to a fault. Often I found her in the cramped office outside her lab asleep with her head on her desk. I would lift her small body up and carry her through the peeways. Sailors stood against the walls to make room for me to pass, never missing an opportunity to heckle me.
Finally bagged her, eh, Willie? What'd it take, Will? Drank dart or a shot of tequila? Make way for Prince Charming, boys.
I endured the jabs without a care in the world. I deposited her in her bunk, pulled the covers up, and turned the small noisemaker on. They were good for helping folks stay asleep. The berths weren't separated by shifts, and bunkmates were constantly coming and going. The hard surfaces throughout the vessel made for a noisy existence. Reading people was part of my job. After a few weeks, I knew what Lynn saw in genetics, the promise of a civilized human race. She believed that somewhere in the human genome lay the answer to why some people were evil. To her, the key to the looking glass was simply identifying the genetic basis for all the traits that ailed the world and getting rid of them. Yuri, on the other hand, didn't believe that the threat of nuclear war was humanity's greatest enemy. Pandemics, he argued, had decimated the human population far more than any war. He believed that globalization and urbanization made an extinction-level pandemic inevitable. It was then that I realized the truth. No one knew what the looking glass was, even the scientists working on the project. I would later learn that the entire project had begun as a mere hypothesis, a hypothesis that a device could be created that would secure the human race forever.
The scientific experiments being conducted on the Beagle were simply gathering data to test that hypothesis, to figure out exactly what that device might be. To these scientists, the looking glass represented an abstract concept like paradise, something we all understood, but no one knew exactly where it was or precisely what it looked like. To some, it was a sandy beach, to others, a cabin in the woods, or a penthouse in the city with unlimited wine and theater tickets. Paradise was the product of one's life experiences and desires. In the same way, every scientist saw humanity's greatest threat through the lens of their field of expertise. They imagined themselves and their work in the starring role in the device's creation. If you put 7 Sitium members in a room and asked them to name the most likely extinction-level event in humanity's future, you might get 7 different answers. Robotics, artificial intelligence, pandemics, climate change, solar events, asteroid impacts, or alien invasion. Creating one device that shielded humanity from all these threats seemed impossible to me. I would later learn that it was in fact possible, but it came at an unimaginable price. Peyton stood from the couch and paced away from the pages, which lay beside Desmond. He sprang up and joined her, seeming to read her feelings. "Just because your mother was in the Sitium back then doesn't mean she's involved with what's happening now." She stared into his eyes. "He still knows me so well." "And what if she is?"
"Then we'll deal with it."
"I can't."
"We will. Together."
He pulled her into his arms and held her, neither speaking for a long moment. With her mouth pressed into his shoulder, she whispered, "What does it mean, Des? All the connections. My mother and father were both in the Sitium. So was Yuri, the man who recruited you. Your uncle met my father in an orphanage in London. It's like we're all entangled."
"I don't know, but I think you're right. There's a larger picture here. I just can't figure out what it is."
He released her and stepped to the corkboard, as if he were searching it for the answer. He reached out and pulled a piece of scrap paper from the pin that held it. It read, "Invisible Sun, person, organization, or project?" Peyton thought he was going to reveal what he was thinking, but he merely slipped the note in his pocket and turned to her.
"Let's keep reading. See if we can figure out what's going on."
Chapter 81 The Beagle put ashore at ports all over the world. I got to use my knack for foreign languages, but I didn't get to enjoy the scenery much. I was always on guard, planning for what might go wrong and making contacts in case they did. In Rio de Janeiro in 1967, I was glad I had made contingency plans and that I had the contacts to execute them. I was at the hotel on a Wednesday night when one of the researchers, a female biologist in her early 30s named Sylvia, threw open the lobby's glass door and ran in. Blood covered her face and matted her brown hair. One of her eyes was swollen shut. She barreled past the bar and the people checking in, yelling my name. I was sitting in the lobby reading a book. I rose, caught her by the arm, guided her to a phone booth, and closed the folding door. I finally got her calmed down enough to speak.
"They took them!"
"Who?"
"Yuri and Lin."
"Who took them?" She was sobbing now.
"I don't know. They wore masks."
She shook her head as if she didn't want to remember.
"They said they'd kill them if I didn't come back to the bus stop with $20,000 in 2 hours.
I took her up to my room after that, questioned her more, then called for 2 of my intelligence operatives. I sent one of them to the Beagle to get $40,000 just in case. We kept a lot of money on hand for scientific provisions as well as kidnap and ransom operations. I sent my other operative to make inquiries with a few of my old MI6 contacts, to find a man I knew only by reputation, but who I was confident would ensure my operation's success. When I was left alone with the trembling woman, I poured her a tall glass of brandy and sat her on the bed. She winced when the liquid hit her cut lip, but with a shaking hand, she finished it quickly.
"Listen to me, Sylvia."
She looked up at me with her good eye, which still leaked tears.
"Everything's going to be okay. I'm going to get them back. I'm going to make the person who did this very sorry."
20 minutes later, I was sitting in the back of a Portuguese restaurant, waiting for my host. He entered, sat without introducing himself, and stared at me with blank eyes. He was a corpulent man, with long, greasy black hair plastered to his scalp. 2 men stood by the door to the private dining room, hands stuffed in their pockets, fingers no doubt curled around the triggers of snub-nosed revolvers pointed in my direction. I knew the man by his alias, O Mestre, but I didn't use the name to address him. I simply said, "We have a common enemy." He raised his eyebrows.
"A wannabe gangster named Ernesto."
His accent was thick Portuguese, his English broken. Never hear of this man. He's kidnapped two associates of mine. He wants $20,000 for their return.
It's police matter. I know the police.
I think you can help me more. I think you can guarantee my friends come home safe. He looked away. There's $40,000 in the bag.
I am not bank.
The money's for their safe return, and for protection in case this happens again, here in Rio and in Sao Paulo. With his head, he motioned to the two men. One opened the bag and began counting the money. The other jerked me up from my chair, frisked me, then reached inside my shirt, making sure I wasn't wired. I wasn't stupid enough to carry a gun into a meeting like this. The man who frisked me nodded at Omestre, who rose and left the room. I'd held back on the fact that I spoke Portuguese, hoping it would provide an advantage, but these men seemed to have a language all their own, communicating entirely with their eyes and slight motions of their heads. The man holding the bag took $20,000 out of it. His associate said to me in Portuguese, "The fee is $20,000 per year. You will return to this room next year on this day with payment." I nodded. So they knew more about me than I suspected. "Tonight, you'll go to the bus stop. Here's what will happen." Exactly 2 hours after the thugs had taken Yuri and Lynn off the street and assaulted Sylvia, I stood in the drizzling rain wearing a fedora and a black trench coat. Rio was hot year-round, but in August it was coldest and rainy. The wind from the Atlantic carried a cold front from Antarctica into the city, past the cranes that were building skyscrapers by the dozen, erasing the old city, erecting a shiny new one. People from Brazil's countryside were pouring into Rio. Illegal immigrants came too, all in search of jobs and a better life. Large slums called favelas grew like ant colonies, seeming to spread overnight. In the glow of the street lamp, I could see the shanties stretching up a green forested mountainside, a pocket of poverty in the vast city. From my vantage point, they looked like tiny cardboard boxes stacked at the feet of the Christ the Redeemer statue, which towered over all the people below. The harsh quality of life in the favelas was a stark contrast to Copacabana Beach a few hundred yards away, where ritzy hotels, nightclubs, bars, and restaurants glittered just off the Atlantic. Palm trees towered over the sandy beach and lined the promenade. Music thumped into the night, an out-of-tune anthem of the two worlds that existed here in Rio. I was about to descend into the other world, the underworld, where desperate people took desperate actions to survive, and just maybe lift themselves out of poverty. The situation had forced me to do something I didn't like, but such was this world. My people were in danger. More than that, my friends were in danger. It was as simple as that. The bus pulled away, puffing thick black smoke the rain couldn't force down. Beside me, Sylvia started to tremble. I knew it wasn't because of the cold wind or the rain. "It's all right, Sylvia." I could tell she wanted to cry, but she resisted. One of my intelligence operatives was in the cafe behind us, the other in the adjacent alley. A rattling Volkswagen pulled up, and a man wearing a bandana over his mouth and a stained white tank top got out. In the back seat, another man pointed a handgun at Sylvia. Her cry broke forth then. I held my arm out, across her, and stepped in between the man and the trembling woman. "The money!" he yelled. "Give us our people first, then we pay." He shook his head. He was high on amphetamines of some sort. His eyes were wide, darting back and forth. "No, you pay now! If I'm not back in 5 minutes, we kill one!" I held my hands up. "All right, fine, we'll pay. But I want to see them first. Show me they're alive. I make a call, and the money is delivered here." Mandana man made eye contact with the driver, who nodded. He grabbed my arm and shoved me in the back of the tiny car, between him and the thug who had the gun. The thug pressed his old revolver in my side. His friends searched me quickly, found no weapon, then jerked my hat off and tied the bandana from his face around my eyes. It stank of sweat and cigarettes, forcing me to cough. They bounced me around in the back seat for 10 minutes. The roar of the German car's engine was nearly deafening. I wondered if the divider between the back seat and the engine compartment had been taken out. Finally, the car stopped, and they stood me up and perp-walked me down a cobblestone street. They were rough with me each time I tripped. I heard a wooden door scrape open and slam close behind us. They walked me slower and pulled my bandana off in a room with a single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Yuri and Lynn were in wooden chairs. Electrical wire bound their hands together behind them, and more wire bound their ankles to the chair legs. They looked painfully uncomfortable. Yuri's nose was busted. Dried blood covered the area around it. More blood ran from his hair. One eye was closed, just like Sylvia. My heart broke when I saw Lynn. It had struck her in the cheek. It was swollen and bruised, like a jellyfish tattooed on her skin.
Tears ran down her cheeks. A man wearing a Che Guevara hat rose from behind a desk. The edges of his nose were red from snorting drugs. He fidgeted as he moved, stared at me, disgust plain on his face.
You think you can play games with me?
He took a knife from his belt.
I'm going to show you how serious I am.
I made my voice even. Before you do, I have a message for you, from Omestre. He stopped, stared, still enraged, but I could see hesitation now.
He's a friend of mine. He wants you to call home.
He screamed obscenities at me, but he didn't move toward Lynn or Yuri.
Call home, check on your family, or Omestre will make you sorry.
How to kill you, you imperialist pig, and your capitalist whore!
That would displease Omestre. I can't even imagine what he would do.
The kidnapper looked away from me. He took a step toward Yuri and Lynn, then seemed to reconsider. At the desk, he picked up the phone, dialed, and listened. Whatever was said on the other end scared him to death. He sank into his seat and nodded, as if the person he was talking to could see him.
Of course, my mistake.
He stopped. Apparently, the line had gone dead. He replaced the receiver and shouted to his men to cut Yuri and Lynn loose, as if it was all a big mistake they'd made. Yuri stood on faltering legs, bracing himself on the chair. But when they cut Lynn loose, she just tumbled toward the floor. I lunged forward and caught her. If not for the warmth of her skin, I might have thought her dead. I hoisted her up and carried her out of the shack in the favela, holding her tightly. I don't think I really exhaled until the thugs let us out of the car at the bus stop. Lynn could stand again, but she still held me tight.
Yuri hugged me too, an unusual show of affection for the man.
You saved us, William. Just doing my job, I mumbled. It was more than that. You would have done the same for me.
Yes, I would have.
Every 3 months or so, the Beagle docked at an island in the Pacific. The same island every time. I didn't know its location. No one except the bridge crew did. But I knew it was west of Hawaii, south of the equator, and that it had been uninhabited when it had first come into the Sishim's possession. Everything was new here, the buildings, the port, the roads. There was no government save for the Sishim, and no crime, no fear. Perhaps for that reason alone, the Beagle sailed for the island right after Rio. The entire crew was shaken, not just Sylvia, Lynn, and Yuri. Yuri and Lynn had grown up in near constant danger. He in Stalingrad during the German invasion, she in Hong Kong during the Japanese occupation. But I think they hadn't experienced real-life threatening danger in 20 years, since their childhood. It scared them, though Yuri was stoic as usual. On the sub, Lynn told me how he had fought them. He had been brave, but it was a useless fight. All the same, I liked him even more for it. I don't know the island's official designation, but aboard the Beagle we called it the Island of Sishim, or simply the Isle. It had a deep water harbor on its south side, with a massive seaport that was way too large for such a small landmass. Every time we docked, there was a cargo ship unloading supplies, building materials mostly, and some heavy equipment. The cost of building on the island was enormous, but I saw the logic in it. This place was completely off the grid and extremely hard to find. Most people don't realize how vast the Pacific is. Every continent and landmass on the planet could fit within the Pacific. It's larger than the Atlantic and Indian Oceans combined. The Isle was the perfect place for the Sishim to hide, and in August of 1967, it was the perfect place for our crew to recuperate. We unloaded at the port, rode the electric golf cart to the residential building, and retired to our rooms. The place wasn't fancy, but it was clean and offered privacy. Every bedroom had its own bathroom and a small living room. After 3 months on the Beagle, it felt like a vast penthouse apartment. Being able to shower in privacy was a luxury. Sleeping without a person above and below you, and three more across from you, was refreshing and quiet. In my time in the field, I found that a brush with death always changes a person. Some not permanently, but everyone temporarily. That was true for Yuri and Lynn. Yuri turned inward. On the Isle, he poured himself into his work. He was more convinced than ever of its importance. Lynn changed in the opposite direction. She stopped working herself to the bone. In the cafeteria, she laughed more, stayed longer at the lunch table. At our post-tour bonfire on the beach, I saw her have a glass of wine for the first time. She absolutely glowed in her black dress. To me, that night, she was brighter than the moon, and the tiki torches, and the candles in the glass vases that lined the long table. I couldn't help staring at her. I tried to hide it less with every drink. There were 6 people left at the table when she stood, said goodnight to the rest of the table, and looked me in the eye.
Nice night for a walk.
I stood and held out my hand. Chapter 82.
In the summer of 1967, my life changed forever. I was 3 months into my second tour in the Beagle when I began noticing a change in Lynn. She was more distant, avoiding me. We had been dating, such as it was on board a submarine, for about 6 months. I cornered her, wouldn't let her deny something was wrong, and finally got the answer out of her. She was pregnant. I was overjoyed and terrified. I believe people who had a difficult childhood are more averse to having children. That was certainly the case for Lynn and for me. If biology hadn't intervened, who knows where life might have led us. But it did, and I will never regret that. We moved back to London, into a flat in Belgravia that was owned by a member of the Sitium, who rented it to us for a song. We got married in a small ceremony a month later. Yuri was my best man. Father and mother were there, as were Lynn's father and mother. On a snowy night in March, our son Andrew was born. We both felt that our lives changed in an instant. From then on, nothing was more important than him. The doctors called his condition Amelia, a birth defect in which one or more limbs are missing. In Andrew's case, his left arm below the elbow was missing. Lynn was crushed. No matter what I said, she felt responsible. She blamed her genes and her behavior, conceiving a child on a nuclear submarine where radiation may have caused the condition. I could never bring myself to use the words genetic defect, but to Lynn, the answer clearly lay in genetics. After that, the looking glass took on a whole new meaning for her. Drive became obsession. She talked about a world where no mother would see her child born with a defect, where no child would have to face the world at a disadvantage or endure daily ridicule from his peers. His condition most certainly didn't change our love for him. Andrew was a smart kid, which I believe he got from his mother, and adventurous to a fault, perhaps my contribution. He was brave and curious and never backed down. Changes were afoot within the Sitium. The experiments were growing in scale, and that required increasing amounts of money. So new members were recruited. Billionaires, financiers, people with their hands on the levers of government research spending. They were all cut from the same cloth. People who believed the world was on the brink of catastrophe. The influx of new members was a turning point for the organization, a Rubicon crossed unceremoniously. On the surface, things remained the same. Dozens of Sitium cells were conducting looking glass research, and the members met every quarter at a conference we called our conclave. But behind the scenes, the organization was fraying. Each member increasingly thought that their own looking glass project was the sole solution for humanity's problems, and jockeyed for the funds they needed to make their vision a reality. In 1972, I became head of Sitium Security, a new organization dedicated to securing the cells and keeping our secrets. Only four of us, me and three of the Sitium's oldest members, knew the full breadth of the Sitium. We were creating a monster. At home, life had settled into a pattern. I was gone a good bit, but when I was home, I spent every spare minute with Lynn and Andrew. He was growing up so quickly. We welcomed a daughter in 1973. We named her Madison, my mother's maiden name. Andrew was the most dedicated older brother I've ever seen. He may have been even more protective than Orville Hughes had been in that orphanage in London after the war. Lynn worked herself to exhaustion. I worried about her, but the subject of how much she worked was a non-starter, so I gave up arguing about it. In marriage, as in war, some battles are unwinnable. Our second daughter was born in 1977. We named her Peyton, Lynn's paternal grandmother's maiden name. On the whole, she was more serious than Madison and more inquisitive. She had the same curiosity and passion for adventure as Andrew. I spent countless hours on planes and trains wondering what the three of them would be like when they grew up and what sort of world they'd live in. Then at the Sitium's winter conclave in Geneva in 1983, the unthinkable happened. A cell unveiled a plan for the looking glass. A functioning device that would accomplish our dream of securing humanity. The scale and cost of the project was incredible. Much of the science was still theoretical then, but has been proven since. But it was a working solution. War, famine, disease, climate change, meteor impacts, cosmic events, extraterrestrial interference, artificial intelligence. The looking glass proposed that night at the lavish home overlooking Lake Geneva would protect us from all those threats and many more. Even more impressive, it had the potential to unravel the great mystery the Sitium had pursued since its founding, the purpose of humanity, the very nature of the universe and human existence itself. The scientists who proposed the looking glass saw it as the next step in the march of human experience, our inevitable destiny. Not everyone was convinced. The group of rational, even-tempered scientists I had come to know turned savage that night. The debate began as a spirited discussion and ended in screaming. I finally realized that we had been playing a zero-sum game. At the end of the Looking Glass project, there would be only one winner. Only one device would be built.
All other projects would be shuttered. The funds funneled to the winning project, and whoever controlled that device would have a power never before seen on Earth. Indeed, they would control the entire human race. The night ended in a stalemate. Members made threats. Some said they would quit the organization and continue their research on their own, starting a new kind of arms race. Others threatened to expose the entire project. If their solution wasn't chosen, they would prevent anyone else from succeeding. Scientists, like all humans, can be very vindictive. If I am guilty of anything, it's negligence. I didn't sense the ground moving beneath my feet. I took the words screamed that night for what they appeared to be, idle threats. Others did not. A month later, I was flying from Cairo to London on a British Airways flight when it happened. Around the world, Sishian scientists were assassinated. I had 12 Sishian security agents in my employ. All were killed. I was unaware of this when I arrived at Heathrow. Indeed, in the cab on the way to the flat in Belgravia, my mind was only on Madison's birthday party, which was the following week. The door to the flat was locked. When it swung open, I saw instantly that our home had been ransacked. I drew my sidearm, but it was too late. In my peripheral vision, I saw a figure dressed in black standing in my office off the foyer, the glass pocket doors closed, obscuring him. I spun, bringing my weapon up, but he was quicker. The bullet ripped through the glass into my side and blew me back against the console table and the antique mirror that hung above it. But I didn't lose my grip on the Sig Sauer P226. I squeezed the trigger, fired 3 rounds, and saw the man fall. I spun, moved to the dining room. That action saved my life. The second man was in the kitchen. His shots into the foyer barely missed me. I fired through the wall, blind, then burst into the kitchen through the butler's pantry, catching him from behind. I'd winged him. I didn't wait for him to turn. I shot him through the shoulder. He dropped the weapon. I stood over him, held the gun in his face, listened for a movement from my study, but heard none.
"Who sent you?"
Blood oozed from his mouth. He was European, with a close-cropped haircut, military or former military. He gnashed his teeth, grunted. I grabbed his jaw, dug my fingers into his cheeks, separating his clenched teeth, but I was too late. He had cracked the tooth. The poison had already slid down his throat. I grabbed a ladle from the kitchen, forced the handle down his throat, and tried to gag him, but his body was already going limp. Holding my side, I raced to the study. The other man was dead too. My files were gone. The safe lay open. I grabbed the phone and dialed Lynn's office at the university. No answer. I tried to stop the bleeding in my side. I'd need a doctor soon. I dialed my Sishim assets in London. No answer. Berlin. No answer. Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, San Francisco. They were all gone. I raced to our master bedroom. Drawers lay open. Our luggage was gone. So was the children's. I counted that as a good sign. I heard footsteps in the foyer. I peeked out into the main hall, expecting to see a Bobby,